I want my 5280 gig now!
Studios Weekend Geek Update. We are on the road at Denver Pop Culture Comic Con, and I'm sitting down with local author John Messenger, who has served our country well, and thank you for your service.
I appreciate it.
And now you are turning your experiences and what you've encountered in the world into your craft, your art.
So yeah, so for the past 17 years I've been a active duty Army officer, definitely have started using that in a lot of my writing. In fact, the first things that I wrote were all science fiction, but it was all military science fiction. And so
that is cool. I don't think there's enough science fiction military.
Right. And the first series was actually pretty interesting. I wrote it while I was deployed to Iraq.
Okay.
I was there on a 15-month deployment, and when you finish your 14 hours of shift for the day, there's not really anything else to do in the middle of Baghdad. So I'd spend an hour or two a night writing and managed to finish this trilogy. And but the whole thing is very interesting because it's told from an alien alliance perspective as they try to stop the spread of humanity.
Oh, very cool. Have you watched it's on Netflix, Death Robots and
Yes, was it Death Sex and Robots or something
yes,
like that?
The short stories that they compiled, especially with like the military with the werewolves,
right,
and the one in space, I just was like, oh
yeah, those are pretty fantastic.
So good. Do you find yourself, is that your comfort zone, or I mean, where do you want to end up, or where do you really want to explore it?
So that was my comfort zone for a while. So I wrote that trilogy, and then I wrote a standalone military science fiction book.
Mm-hmm.
And that was where I thought I would be comfortable. And then ironically enough, I got a publishing contract for something completely unrelated. I entered this writing competition for this publisher, and they wanted a novella, and I openly admit that I absolutely wrote a contemporary Avatar The Last Airbender. And it was a 100-page story. I turned it in. They loved it, and they said, well, we love this. We'd love to give you a publishing contract, but we want this to be a series. And I was like, well, I can't. That's already a cartoon. Like, I can't. People are going to know. And so I definitely had to...
Act 2 is going to be a dead giveaway for that.
And so, yeah, I wound up writing this series, but had to take it a completely different direction because I can't help but feel that people are going to notice. And ironically, that's my best-selling but least favorite series that I've written. And then I just decided, I've always been a big fan of like Frank Herbert and Dune and things like that, where he created his own universe and his fantastic worlds. And I thought, why not give it a try? And so I started writing a steampunk series. I was actually just talking on a panel. We were on a panel about world building.
Right.
And I was talking about how this book started off as sci-fi because that was my comfort zone. That was my go-to. And I was thinking, I was like, that's going to be great. You know, these aliens are going to come down and invade the U.S. And there's going to be this guy that's on the east or the west coast that wants to get to the east coast to get to retrieve his loved ones. You know, heart-wrenching, gut-wrenching story.
Right.
And the more I thought about it, and the more I just kind of figuring out how the rest of the world would react to this. And is this worldwide or is this localized? I started thinking about Canada, of all things. And I said, how would Canada react to the United States being invaded? And this was, God, I started writing this 7 or 8 years ago. And ironically, the first thing I came up with is, oh, well, they'd build a wall.
See, the Canadian border, that's the border we need to be looking
at. There's the trouble.
That's the trouble spot.
And so, yeah, so I had this whole idea about, like, Canada isolating itself. And if people came across that they believed to be infected, they would automatically, you know, take them out. And I realized that wasn't the right setting. It wasn't really working for me. And I read a couple steampunk books. And I realized, no, this could really work as a steampunk book. But I'm going to make my own world. Like, it's going to have the flavor, it's going to have the flair of Victorian England, but it's going to be its own thing out there.
Right.
And that's kind of what spawned the Magic and Machinery series, which is what I've been writing for the past 6 years now.
Wow. Has it been, because you're an independent publisher, correct?
So I've got some books that are independently published. I've got some that are under a publisher as well.
Preference?
Yeah. Since I don't think my publisher's going to hear this...
No,
it's a mixed bag. There's definitely benefits to being under a publisher. They pick up a lot of the costs that when I was self-published, I definitely had to absorb, and that made it tough. You know, when you're spending $1,000 on a book and you have no idea how well it's going to do,
That's a big price tag.
Yeah, that's tough. Under the publisher, they pick up cover art, they pick up editing, they pick up formatting. You just have to write the book and get it out there, which is great. But on the flip side, you know, there's sometimes you I think it's inevitable in anything. You wind up butting heads with people, personality conflicts, and you keep thinking to yourself, this was a lot easier when I did it myself.
I didn't have anyone else to bullshit with. I can imagine that. So when you were growing up, I mean, what did you lean more towards? I mean, was there like a genre?
Oh, I was sci-fi to the core.
The whole way, huh?
Yeah. So I grew up overseas. My dad worked for the American embassies, and we didn't actually have a lot of English books available.
Okay.
But we wound up with a lot of stuff like Robert Heinlein and Isaac Asimov. And so I grew up reading these, what I didn't realize at the time were absolute classic science fiction books. And that was my go-to. Like, I fell in love with it. And then when I was deployed, right before I was deployed, I was reading a series by Walter John Williams called Praxis. It's Praxis something. If he hears this, I apologize. But it was kind of the same idea where humans were kind of seen as the bad guys and all these aliens had made this alliance together.
Right.
And it became this inspiration for the science fiction. And science fiction was always my go-to. And then it just started branching out after I realized that there's other things out there.
Wow. That's cool. So, what? Because, I mean, just to stay in the science fiction thing and to go on, what are you gelling on now? Because, I mean, there's a lot out there. And, I mean, are you finding it that it's difficult to write because you're getting cross-pollination?
Yes.
Or, you know, how are you overcoming that? Or where are
so
you sitting?
I try, if I'm going to write in a certain genre, I try to read in that genre, too. It keeps my mindset in the right world. When I first started writing this, I was actually reading, it's called Lotus Wars.
Yes, I know Lotus Wars.
And I was blown away by it because it had never dawned on me that other cultures could have steampunk. Like, steampunk was a Victorian England thing. Like, what do you mean Japan has airships? Like, that's crazy. So that series was amazing, and I absolutely loved it. I read that. I read Leviathan, which, again, I didn't realize was a staple of steampunk at the time. And those were just fantastic and really get you in the right mindset and keeps you there as you're reading through.
That's cool. So, when you're sitting out in Baghdad in the middle of a desert, I mean, how intense is that? I mean, did you see a lot of action?
No, I'm a medical guy.
Okay.
So, we were in a hospital in what was called the Green Zone, the international zone there in Baghdad. So we didn't really get shot at, and I try to always couch that, you know, there's a running joke about how, you know, I saw all kinds of combat in Iraq. I was flying in a helicopter. We went inverted. I knew because my medals were flapping me up in the face. So, I mean, realistically, no. What we got was a lot of indirect fire, and still, it's a pulse pounding moment when you hear we had an alert system called the CRAM.
Right.
And whenever the CRAM would go off, you hear this loud siren, and you'd know something's about to hit right around you because it was partitioned off for different areas.
Mm-hmm.
So if you heard it, and it was close, that meant the rocket was close. And so you'd run to a bunker, and it was intense.
Just hung out, huh?
Yeah.
So with that kind of experience, have you been able to translate a lot of that, do you think, more vividly with your character development or the story arcs and all that?
Absolutely. One of the books that I wrote right after I came back, and not that I'm trying to, it's not a sympathy plea or anything.
There's
a book that I wrote called Rage, and it's a standalone book. And it's about this soldier that was conscripted to go off to fight in a war in a foreign planet. And it was it had a World War I feel. There was trench warfare. But his side of the forces wound up using a lot of nuclear weapons and kind of annihilated a lot of the planet. The other side used a lot of biological weapons.
Right.
He gets exposed to something called the Rage Virus. And now every time he has this spike of adrenaline, he starts losing control and becomes, well, a little bit cannibalistic.
Just a touch. Nibble. Yeah. I don't want to eat all of you. Maybe a digit or two.
And so I wrote this. And when you read the first third of it, it's all about him at war and how does... You know, now he's been exposed, and now he's just going crazy on the battlefield and everything else. And can he control this monster? So it's a Dr. Jekyll, Mr. Hyde story.
Mm-hmm.
But the second two-thirds of the book, and I never play this up as much, but people realize as they start reading, the war ends. You know, the people that have been exposed to the Rage Virus, he's able to become the alpha male and kind of keep them under control and use them as a weapon to win this war. And afterwards, they are shipped back, and the forces have an option at that point. Do you destroy these people that are now still people but now beasts, or do you try to reintegrate them into society?
Right.
And so they don't let him go back to Earth. They send him to a Mars colony, and it's about this guy and his friends who are all separated from each other because they don't want him around each other in case they start feeding off one another. and can he rejoin civilization when he no longer feels civilized?
Right.
And so it was a science fiction take on PTSD, you know, because no matter what your experiences are in war, you are changed by it. And you come back and you realize, maybe not for the medical side nearly as much.
Right.
We see a lot of horrible things, but we're also not the ones out there kicking in doors and having to make that split minute decision.
You're not on that razor's edge.
Right. But those guys that come back, they do things in war, whether even if it's all the right things, that changes them. And now they understand and they feel like there's this beast inside of them. You know, they did things in war and they can either come back and talk to someone about it and try to cope, or they can do what most people do and they just push it way, way down and hope it doesn't rear its head.
Right.
And that's when you start seeing these soldiers that have anger issues, where they want to come back and rejoin civilization, but they're driving down the road and someone cuts two car lengths in front of them and they absolutely lose their shit. And so that was kind of the idea behind Rage was you're supposed to feel sorry for this guy because he's in just a terrible situation. He can't go see his family. He makes one phone call to his family and is under the impression that his wife has moved on without him. Whether it's true or not, we never even delve into it.
Right.
That's just the perception. And you're supposed to feel bad for this guy, but as the more you read, the more you realize he may not actually be the protagonist. Like, he may seriously have some issues. Like, we need to get some help for this guy.
When people try to kill you, and it's more than one, they may not be the problem.
Right.
So when you're creating these characters and you're doing all of this work, have any of them gotten out of control and you're like, God, I never envisioned, especially in the Rage one. I mean, I can only imagine, did it really like pull on like the darker side and you just keep writing him more and more? Like, how do I get him back? Did
yeah,
he hit the rails?
He was tough because I'd be lying if I said that I had some terrible form of PTSD, but I think everyone that comes back has some level of
stress. Anyone who serves
stress.
Comes back different.
Right. So I don't think it was pulling on me nearly as much, but there's some of my favorite quotes came out of that book, and I think I wrote the story and kind of let the character take his own path.
Right.
And kind of go down that dark path with him as he struggles to wonder if is he being paranoid?
Mm-hmm.
Or are people really out to get him?
Right.
And so I kind of let the character write himself, and he went down some dark paths, make no mistake. But I always knew, like, there were some key points I wanted to hit on, some ideas that, and there's a quote in there. There's two quotes that I love that came out of that book, and it's ironic because I think it's my least read book. I think maybe 100 and some people have read this book.
Really?
Totally.
This sounds amazing. I need to read this book.
But one of the quotes was this idea that when you come back from war, everyone throws you this ticker tape parade, because everyone's so excited to see you back. And everyone assumes that you're the guy in the parade enjoying the ticker tape, and the truth is, you're the ticker tape. You're colorful and you're bright and fancy, and everyone loves you at the moment. But as soon as the parade's over, they send someone in to go sweep you up and push you to the side. And the other quote was that when I read stories as a child, I always heard the stories from my parents about the knight in shining armor saving the damsel in distress from the fire-breathing dragon.
Right.
And all I wanted out of my life was to grow up to be the knight in shining armor. Except that I didn't. I grew up to be the fire-breathing dragon. So instead of being what people ran to when they were scared, I was the thing they were afraid of.
I was the one invoking the fear.
Yeah.
See, that's intense. And that's amazing. I don't think sci-fi is doing that enough. It's the political side and it's all of that. Mm-hmm. It's not as much, you know, the internal analysis that goes on. Like, Twilight Zone was so good about, you know, still dealing with the issues, but it was more about
the repercussions
and the person's perspective, mm-hmm. and just how Sterling would just put that twist in there.
Yeah, and admittedly, I think that my dad was a Vietnam vet,
mm-hmm.
and I've heard all the stories about how tough it was to come back after Vietnam.
See, and my father is the opposite. I mean, we hardly ever get any of those stories. Mm-hmm. It has to be a moment that either he's feeling nostalgic or because he flew one of the first jets in Nam. So they had a special on, and he's like, I know this, and we would bomb, you know, we'd hit the deck, and he, I mean, he's using terms that I've never heard him use, and I'm like, where is this?
And I think that's probably true for a lot, because not to take anything away from Iraq and Afghanistan,
no,
but the type of combat that we did in Iraq and Afghanistan was very different from what happened in Nam, where, you know, you're in the jungle and
it's close.
They're popping out of holes right in front of you, and it's crazy. And I mean, just the sheer volume of deaths that happened during Vietnam.
Mm-hmm.
The big problem that we had with Iraq and Afghanistan was, especially in the medical side, so many people were injured. But we also had about a 98% survival rate. If you made it to the hospital, we were going to get you home.
Right. That wasn't
and
the case.
That wasn't the case back then.
Nope.
I mean, people were getting injured, and you're so deep in the jungle, you're going to die, and that's the problem.
If you made it to the chopper,
right.
If the chopper made it to you.
And the chopper's got to find somewhere to land, and you're in the jungle.
Yes.
You've got to find a clearing somewhere. And so, yeah, I think that my dad's the same way. He didn't really talk much about what happened in Vietnam.
Mm-hmm.
But when my brother and I both joined the Army, he talked a lot about what it was like to come back. My brother went down to Haiti on a peacekeeping mission in the 90s.
Right.
I went to Iraq twice, and I did a peacekeeping mission in Haiti as well in 2010 for the earthquake. Our experiences were very different, but our returns were also very different. You know, in Vietnam, they'd always talk about how horrible it was to come back, and people were spitting on you and all of this. And people treated us pretty well when we came back. I mean, you had whole organizations. There was a stop we would always do in Maine as you're flying back. And there was a whole organization of vets and volunteers that would have cell phones available. So, like, the second you landed in Maine, they would hand you a cell phone and say, hey, call your family.
All right.
You know, we want to take care of you guys, you know. The scenes that you saw in the Budweiser commercials of people walking through the airport and everyone cheering, that happened. I mean, people really cheered for you. And so I think that even though we've categorized PTSD a lot better now, we still don't want to talk about it.
No.
You know, we still want to have the science fiction stories that talk about all the awesome things that happen in war. But we don't want to talk about what happens afterwards.
No. And the political climate and the cultural environment was so different back, because nobody wanted to be in there.
Mm-hmm.
No one knew why we were there.
Right.
And now, well, everyone still doesn't know why we're there, because they haven't found shit. But they're still supportive of their family, of the troops, of the mission.
And that's the interesting thing, is that support for the war was always low,
mm-hmm.
but support for the troops was always really high.
And I think that's the key.
I think they realized the difference that they never realized during Vietnam, where you had all these guys getting conscripted. I mean, they were drafted into the war. They didn't have a choice. We were a volunteer force going into Iraq and Afghanistan, but people still understood that this was our job.
Right.
We didn't have a choice. We couldn't just say, I'm a conscientious objector, I'm not going to go to war. Because then they're like, all right, guy, we got some problems for you here. Yeah.
Here you go.
And so I think people started to divorce the two and realize that I don't have to support the war to realize that it's tough on the guys on the ground.
Mm-hmm. And trust us, they don't want to be there any more than we want them there. So where are you at currently? I mean, what are you writing on?
I've been working on the steampunk series. I took about a 3-year hiatus when my youngest was born and everything
else.
Thank you. And much to the chagrin of my readers. So I try to make it up for them when I publish book 4, which actually comes out next month. It's 140,000 words. My publisher and editor asked me why this was not 2 books. And I tried to explain. I was like, they waited 3 years for this book. Like, let's give them something.
Make it worth their while. I mean,
right.
George R. R. Martin, Stephen King, even Dean Koontz. I mean, they can do it deaf. So
I'm pretty sure at this point George R. R. Martin's book had better be like 4,000 fucking words. Or 4,000 fucking pages long. Like, seriously, like,
goddamn phone book.
I want to see his next book come out like Encyclopedia Britannica here.
You know, and it would only serve the fans right, that ones that have complained that I don't like the way this ended. Here you go.
Yeah. Enjoy.
Fun with that.
I did appreciate when he made a joke one time and said that he's going to change it up from the show, and within the first 20 pages, he's going to have the White Walkers kill everyone, and the entire rest of the book is just going to be description of the snow.
I like that.
He's going to be like, screw you, everyone's dead, and then it was cold.
Did you watch?
I did, yeah.
Did you enjoy it, or were you kind of like the rest of the fandom?
So I enjoyed it, but I think like a lot of fans, I thought it was rushed. And I think that one of the things that made Game of Thrones so amazing for 7 seasons was they capitalized on the lulls. They capitalized on the downtime between these crazy activities.
Mm-hmm.
And then you get to season 8 and they have this huge battle against the dead in Winterfell. And then the next episode, they're in King's Landing. And they skipped like 2 months of an army marching all the way south.
Yeah.
And so when you have storylines like Dany's storyline in there where she starts slipping into this Mad Queen persona, you realize you have to take a step back and realize, number one, she's been saying all along, I'm going to burn their cities to the ground. And then when she does it, they're like, oh shit, did that.
There was no surprise in
that. No. But then all of her paranoia that started with talking to John, they never built on that. And if you had taken an episode, and even one episode, where they're marching south and she keeps trying to rekindle this relationship, and he keeps saying, I don't know if I feel comfortable with this, and she keeps seeing how everyone gravitates towards John, and she feels like this, her throne already slipping away before she's captured it, then yeah, you can see where her paranoia is built to the point where she goes batshit crazy.
Mm-hmm. And you can slowly see, especially when they have the dinner and everyone's gathered mm-hmm. around John, and she's just...
And she just excuses herself.
Just sitting there by yeah. herself, and it's just like...
And if they had built on that, and that was perfect.
Yes, if they had built on that. We never got any more yeah. off of that, which is disappointing. And I still say it should have ended with the White Walker fight. We should have went to King's Landing, should have kicked Cersei's ass, mm-hmm. and then the White Walkers finally made it, and then, yeah, okay.
I will say, so I watched that episode with my wife, who's also active duty, mm-hmm. And then went to work with a bunch of active duty people, and we had lengthy conversations about the Battle of Winterfell, and that's not how you use cavalry. No. What is wrong with you?
I was wondering, I'm like, what the hell? Why are they charging in there? You got catapults, you got distance, you start picking those bastards off. Instead, no. The horse guys just go charging in there like a bunch of idiots in the
and
dark.
And don't get me wrong, visually stunning. When you see yeah. all the lights start flickering out, you're like, oh shit, something yeah. bad's about to happen.
Oops. Here we go.
But then you start looking at it and you're like, okay, you have trenches that you're setting ready to set on fire. They've got the dragon glass on the actual barricades to help take out the walkers, or the ghouls.
Right.
You have all the things that you need, and you put it behind your army.
Yeah.
Isn't that supposed to be in front of your army? Like, what's wrong with you?
Nothing tactically. Nothing. I think the only one that actually made any sense was the little girl that got crushed by the giant. She was the only one in that fight that made any sense to me. Like, okay. She was like, I'm going to take you out. I'm like, all right, that one I can buy. The rest of them?
And let's admit it, that was the most heartbreaking death in that episode.
That was.
Because who didn't love that little girl?
I know. She was mouthy and just... And I mean, the whole fight between the mountain and the hound, no big surprise.
Right.
But, yeah, that whole fight, Winterfell, just pissed me off. Seriously? But hey, I digress. So, we got totally off topic
yeah.
on that.
So, we were talking about the books. So,
yes.
Yeah, so it's an ongoing series. I have mapped this out at about 13 books right now.
Okay.
It started off as a trilogy, and when we talked about growing out of control,
this is the, totally this went is out the of result.
Control. Yeah, so... Okay. I'm about a third of the way through book 5 already, and so my intent is to have at least a couple books out every year so that my fans don't lose their shit again.
Well, I mean, you've got life happens while you're making other yeah. plans. We get that.
No, they don't.
No, they don't.
No, they don't.
Not for a creative.
I was like, well, my son was born, you know, I was kind of taking time off to take care of him. They're like, but he's older now, right? Like, it's been 3 years. He's totally fine. Like, let's do this thing.
He can take care of himself.
Yeah.
We know how this works.
He knows where the M&Ms are. Like, just give them to him. It's cool.
Here's that
kid. Oh, and that kid, too. Like, we had to move the M&Ms up to a higher shelf. He figured out how to get in the pantry, and he's just like, M&M?
Nice. M&M? That is awesome.
Because that's what I want, a two-year-old. I'm high on sugar.
M&M. I'm not a father. I just take home, like, a soda can, give it back to the parents. Here you go. Pack yourself up. So the new one that comes out next month.
So next month is Apertura Iris.
Okay.
Which is book 4. And this has always been kind of, the whole series has been set up, it's a Sherlock Holmes in a world of magic, and it's set up like, if you've ever seen Bones,
mm-hmm.
where every book is a start and finish of an investigation,
okay.
and then there's an overarching storyline. So the first 5 books are all that, and then we start getting into, okay, we can't, we're not really doing investigations anymore, now we have a bigger problem, a bigger fish to fry.
Very cool. Do you have a release date?
So 1 July will be okay. the release for Apertura Iris.
Where do they need to go to pick up this tasty morsel of literature?
They can go to Amazon and just search my name, John Messenger, J-O-N. Or they can actually go to my author page, which is johnmessengerauthor.com.
Okay.
And there's links to Amazon and everything else off of there as well.
Okay. So for the kids and the people playing at home, what is the best way to stalk you efficiently on the interwebs?
So I have a author page on Amazon, or not, on Facebook, which is John Messenger Author.
Okay.
Pretty easy to find. And then for the rest of social media, it's usually john.messenger.
Excellent. John, thank you for sitting down.
Hey, I appreciate it.
Amazing. Be sure to follow him. We will follow up when the book does come out in next month, and I can't wait to read it myself. John, thank you so much.
Hey, I appreciate it.
Because in the end, we're all stories, so make it a good one.